thing. Yeah, that works. Okay. So I'd like to welcome Sister Catherine Joseph Drosty. She has a doctorate in sacred theology from the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas in Rome. Her other degrees include a Bachelor of Arts in History from Christendom College, a Master's in History from Middle Tennessee State University, and a Master's in Educational Administration from Marymount University. As you can see, a Dominican sister of St. Cecilia, she has a long history of teaching, holding administrative positions at various schools of the congregation. Sister Catherine is currently the Vice Dean of the Theology Faculty of the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas in Rome, researching and teaching on subjects that include the role of the women in the church, Catherine of Siena, and religious life. But if you get a chance to talk to her, something I'd recommend, you're sure to learn a lot on all things worth knowing. Today she's talking to us on Passions and the Virtue of Life, Taming the Menagerie Within. Sister Catherine, welcome.
I just noted a book on Catherine of Siena right at the edge here. And I thought, I'll have to look at that one later, but anyway. Good evening. Thank you for the invitation to speak here this evening at Blackfriars for the Thomistic Institute. It's an honor to be here. My paper is entitled Passion and the Life of Virtue, a broad topic, but I am going to take a particular focus on progression from vice to virtue, from the rule of passion to the rule of reason. To achieve this end, the first part of my talk will address some underlying principles, including the connection of the virtues, the essence of the sensitive appetite and the passions, the moral content of the passions with reference to the nature of the governance of the intellect and the will. And then with these in place, part two will address the progression from virtue to vice, illustrating Thomas Aquinas' fourfold distinction on temperance, intemperance, continence, and incontinence by means of a simple example, the pub. As to sources, numerous works by Thomas Aquinas touch on the topic, but I will primarily be referencing his commentary on the Nicomachean Ethics, De Veritate, and the Summa Theologiae. I would like to begin with a quotation from G.K. Chesterton's Orthodoxy. Written over 100 years ago, he masterfully identified the roots of moral decay during religious decline. Quote, "When a religious scheme is shattered, not merely the vices are let loose. The vices are indeed let loose and they wander and do damage. But the virtues are also let loose. And the virtues wander more wildly and the virtues do more terrible damage. The modern world is full of old Christian virtues gone mad." End quote. One expects what vices to wander and do damage, but how do we understand virtues gone mad? Couched within Chesterton's statement is an ancient principle, which holds that real virtues are connected. According to this principle, the truly just ruler not only possesses justice, but must also have courage. The courageous soldier must be prudent to know when to do battle and when to flee. The truly prudent parent is temperate, just, and courageous, enabling him or her to do the right thing in the right way at the right time. Thomas dedicates an entire question of the Summa Theologiae to the question of the connection of the virtues. Here he references Aristotle and Cicero, as well as the scriptures, Gregory the Great, Augustine, all of whom agree that to possess one virtue without the other means that the virtue possessed is either of no account whatever, or very imperfect, while any person who has a true virtue must have several. By way of emphasis, Thomas states that a virtue cannot be perfect as a virtue if isolated from the others. Thus, when religion is overshadowed and society loses reference to God, all the virtues are detached, disconnected from one another, leaving little hope that man will reach his true end. In such situations, many still speak of virtue, but it is merely a mad facsimile, making it difficult to distinguish virtue from vice. History is filled with examples. Consider the French revolutionaries, who not only enshrined the goddess of reason on the altar of Notre Dame during the Fête de la Raison, but hailed the virtues of liberté, égalité, fraternité as justification for rebellion, anarchy, and regicide. In our own day, debates on virtue and vice swirl around such terms as justice and injustice, fairness and inequality, respect, bigotry, love, hatred. Relativism has rendered clarity asunder, and all virtues and vices now bow before the new queen of virtues, tolerance. And while philosophers and theologians argue over the merits and demerits of tolerance as a virtue, the masses have solidly engrafted it onto the root, onto the tree of relativism, with banners declaring, "You will not offend me, and I will not offend you." Now, how do passions fit into this picture? If virtues perfect the powers of the soul, then a lack of connection, a scattering of virtue, implies that certain powers will lack certain virtues. A reality that's particularly apparent in the context of the sense appetite. A simple example suffices. A father who frequently loses his temper may know that it is not good to yell at his wife or to beat his children. Knowing the pain he causes, he may prudently determine and will not to do it again. But prudence alone is insufficient for virtue. His prudent decision to treat his family justly demands something more. To accomplish this good act, he must be well disposed with regards to the end. And this depends on rectitude of his appetite. Not just the rational appetite, the will, but also the sense appetite. Without the virtues of meekness, gentleness, though the father determines the rational good and wills to choose it, lack of rectitude in the sensible appetite, the seat of the passion of anger, means that the next time he is irritated, passion will most likely overwhelm his good intentions and he will lose his temper just as he has done in the past. Now, the movement of the sense appetite is called the passio. Passio, passion, which comes from the Greek pathē and the Latin pati, meaning to endure, to undergo, to experience. This emphasizes something of a receptive element. However, we have to be careful to avoid thinking that the sense appetite is merely passive. Since a power is named for its act, the sense appetite is called, the sense appetite is called such because once the senses apprehend their object, the corresponding appetite moves towards the object, if it is good, a lovely pint of beer, or away from an evil object, the bear trying to attack me. It is therefore called the moved mover. I don't have time to go fully into the contemporary debates surrounding and distinguishing passion, affection, feeling, and emotion, but I would like to make three comments to help clarify Thomas's understanding of passion. Number one, Thomas does not use the term emotion. He does agree, however, that the passions can be called affections. This is because the affections manifestly belong to the appetitive part of the soul, so too the passions. So he identifies those two in a way. Number two, Thomas sets aside feeling, sensus. In his De Veritate, he distinguishes sadness from pain. Now, pain here he takes in a strict sense as a feeling belonging properly to the body. And it is therefore not a passion because it involves nothing on the part of the soul beyond mere apprehension. The soul apprehends when the body feels pain, something affected by the sense of touch, as when I recently sprained my ankle. As Augustine says, pain is more commonly said of bodies. Sadness, on the other hand, is a cyclical passion. Cyclical here, not cycle as in bicycle or cyclical, but as in psyche. A psychical passion, which begins with the apprehension of a source of harm and ends in an operation of the appetite. And even further, Thomas says, in an alteration of the body. Now, though these are distinct, they are not unrelated. Sadness can cause my heart to feel pain as if it will break. Physical pain can cause sadness. Third point, Thomas distinguishes passion and its subject in the appetite. He says, in a general sense, passio can be applied to any receptive act, and as such can be attributed to any part of the soul and every part of the soul. But in the proper sense, passio is defined as a transformation, a loss of a contrary. This psychical passion is a movement of the non-rational soul due to the apprehension of good or evil. So he says, therefore, it is attributed to the body and properly found only in the sense appetite. However, since the human being is hylomorphic, body and soul, it pertains to the soul indirectly. Now, historically, these movements of the sense appetite, the passions, have been at the heart of passionate arguments, pun intended, most notably in discussions of happiness and virtue. The Epicureans sought happiness in the life of pleasure, whereas the Stoics believed happiness lay in man's nobility, in his ability to rationally choose those things which accord with human nature. So Cicero would define passion as a perturbation, a pathos which is a commotion of the mind repugnant to reason and against nature. If passions are contrary to nature, then the noble Stoic stage must expel them. But even among spiritual writers, including Bernard of Clairvaux, we hear of this taming of the wild beast within. And the renowned moral theologian and Thomist, Servais Pinkers, compares the passions to a menagerie, to such animals as the proud, domineering lion, the scared rabbit, the envious serpent, the mocking monkey, the bragging rooster, the brutal rhinoceros, or even the insipid jellyfish. Now, like all analogies, the menagerie helps on one level, but limps on the other. For though both animals and humans possess a sensitive appetite, a sensitive soul, the irrational menagerie in man belongs to a rational being. Human sentient powers are non-rational, but here non-rational does not imply against reason. Rather, it means without reason. In other words, the sentient soul in man is not a non-rational soul, but is rather both a sensitive and rational soul. This is what C.S. Lewis meant when he wrote that in themselves, passions do not even rise to the dignity of error. As natural movements of the sensitive appetite, responding to sense data, which can come from the imagination, from the memory, from sight, from touch, from any of the senses, passions are morally neutral in themselves. But belonging to the rational nature, they do not remain neutral. Rather, they are properly subject to the command of the reason and of the will, and they are thus morally good or evil by participation. Unlike their counterparts in animals, human passions are designed to be governed by reason. But what is the nature of this governance? Aristotle held that the rational soul does not govern different powers of the body in a univocal manner. To explain, he applied the analogy of civil rule. The rational soul governs the physical body with a despotic rule, such that if I decide to move my finger, its nature is like that of a slave. It cannot resist. It doesn't say, I'm going to go the other direction. It moves where I want it to move. Just as the athlete who trains, even in pain, with aches and pains, he still pushes his muscles so that they can more easily respond to the command of the will. But the soul cannot govern the sensitive appetite in the same way. Why? Because the appetite has something of its own, by virtue whereof it can resist the commands of reason. Reason governs the sense appetite not as a tyrant and slave, but rather with the political rule of a wise ruler to a free citizen. The prudent ruler guides the free citizen, knowing that he or she has the power to accept or reject counsel. The strong city-state is composed not only of virtuous rulers, but of virtuous rulers and virtuous citizens, Just as a virtuous man or woman, has virtue in both the irrational and in the rational powers, in the sensitive powers and in the rational powers. To illustrate, I can return to the menagerie analogy. Human reason is similar to the lion trainer, whose skill lies not in brute force, anger, or loud cries. Anyone can yell and wave a stick and make a wild animal cower. The expert trainer has a higher, more difficult goal. He seeks not only to restrain the animal's power, but to guide it so that the animal will perform a specific action at the proper time. The power of this trainer lies in harnessing the animal's natural strength to accomplish great deeds. The trainer is helpless without the power of the animal. So too is man without the dynamic power of the passions. Now here again the analogy limps due to moral determination of human action. A determination which is complicated by the pivotal role played by pleasure and sorrow. Aristotle taught, and Thomas concurred, that if virtues are about actions and passions, and if every action and passion is followed by pleasure and sorrow, then in this way, virtue is about pleasures and sorrows. Aristotle was so convinced about the connection between pleasure and sorrow and right or wrong human conduct that he declared that the whole concern of both morality and political science must be with pleasures and pains, since the man who treats them rightly will be good, and the one who treats them wrongly will be bad. The problem? We are not impartial judges of pleasure. We often choose sensible pleasure over the rational good. Now, despite this danger, this pleasure-sorrow principle highlights the necessity of passion for virtuous action. If a rational being possesses sensitive powers, and one could have virtue in these powers without passion, you would be depriving the power of its proper act, and this is impossible. Rather, we hold that virtues like courage and patience, which are of the sensitive appetite, necessarily pertain to passion. But even the moral virtues which do not properly involve passion, such as justice, religion, truth, may actually result in passion. Doesn't the just man rejoice in his just deeds? Or the courageous soldier find joy in deeds of courage? Since the lower powers follow the movement of the higher, good acts of the rational powers overflow into the sensitive appetite. The implication is that joy is a natural effect of any act of virtue. Any agreeable operation, any good act, causes pleasure, especially spiritual pleasure. But in the same way, moderate sorrow can be used for avoiding evil. Thomas even considered sorrow to be the mark of a well-conditioned mind according to the present state of life, whereby we will experience evil. This hylomorphic account of virtue involving both the rational and sensible powers is properly human. First, because the human person is virtuous, not in spite of passion, but because of passion. Secondly, because it acknowledges the doctrine of original sin. Though Adam and Eve were created in original justice, whereby reason held perfect hold over the lower powers of the soul, the loss of original justice, without destroying nature, left all human powers destitute of their proper order. After original sin, though the intellect still sought the truth, it was darkened. The will still sought the good, but it was weakened as to its choice of particular goods. And the passions no longer followed the guidance of the intellect and will. Thomas's approach avoids postmodern anthropological theories which err by either overemphasizing the spiritual or overemphasizing the material. Both of these strands absolutize a partial truth, and they are unable to account for the other strand's central thought and central insight. Now, with those foundations, I move to part 2, and the question of how does the human person mature and integrate human passion to achieve perfect self-mastery, virtue. This human excellence can be exemplified by the temperate person who abstains from bodily pleasure and enjoys the very fact of doing so, as opposed to the intemperate person who finds such acts irksome, or the brave man who faces dangers gladly, or at least without distress, in contrast to the coward who experiences fear and great distress in the face of danger. Growth in virtue is not a question of either or. It is not that I either possess virtue perfectly or I have nothing of virtue. Rather, it's a process. Thomas defines it as having a beginning, a middle, and an end. He compares these stages of growth in virtue to natural growth of a human being, from infancy to childhood, where one begins to use speech and to reason, to puberty, when he begins to acquire the power of generation, and so on until he arrives at adulthood. Now, this growth can be applied to both the acquired and infused virtues, but I am going to specifically focus on acquired virtue, human virtue directed and defined according to human reason, that which is caused by human acts. Thomas borrows a fourfold distinction, which I already noted, of virtue, vice, continence, incontinence, from the Nicomachean Ethics, where after having defined virtue and categorizing the cardinal virtues and all the related virtues, Aristotle dedicates an entire chapter to the discussion of continence and incontinence. Now here he identifies six categories or stages related to human self-mastery or its lack. Those that lack include vice, incontinence, lack of self-mastery, and brutishness. On the other side, three levels of self-mastery include virtue, continence, imperfect self-mastery, and what he calls godlike self-mastery. I want to immediately set aside the two extremes, which by their very nature and by their very definition are rare among men. Brutishness, on the one hand, is more common to animals. Thomas will deal with it when he deals with clemency. The opposite extreme is perfect self-mastery, which Aristotle attributed to the gods. Thomas will classify it as the infused virtue. Thomas, though, will even add another level, a still higher level of virtue, the exemplar virtues, which belong to God himself and pre-exist in God just as the type of all things pre-exist in him. But setting those aside, we are left with the four main stages. Virtue opposed to vice, temperance, intemperance, continence opposed to incontinence. Now, one other little aside. Aristotle will argue that continence and incontinence can be exercised about anything, whether it's physical pleasure, anger, greed, ambition, etc. Thomas treats them in a more limited manner, under the virtue of temperance, properly pertaining to moderation of our desires for simple sense pleasure. He does allow, however, that they can be applied relatively to these other objects. The easiest way to elucidate these four stages is by way of example, which what I presume to be a common scenario here in Oxford. Four friends at a local pub on a Wednesday night with beer flowing. All have papers to write, exams to prepare, and lectures early the next morning. For our purposes, I will assume that each person has had two or three pints according to their personal rational limit. Each has reached their personal rational limit, whatever it is. For me, it's half of one. For ease, I will identify the four friends according to their level of virtue or vice. So I will identify them as temperance, continence, incontinence, and intemperance. Now, here again, I want to begin with the next furthest extremes, which is temperance and intemperance. First, there is intemperance, who, having neither virtue nor any intention of controlling her desire for ale, orders another round. In the context of the stages of virtue, Thomas identifies intemperance with childishness, since both the child and the intemperate man or woman are governed by passion, Both, he says, desire something disgraceful, contrary to reason. Both are self-willed and become stubborn when they don't get their way. And both cannot restrain themselves, but must be restrained by another. As to the function of reason, the intellect in intemperance, Thomas calls it habitual. And he compares it to a chronic disease. Since intemperance has no right estimate of the end, of what the good end is, intemperance is not moved by vehement desire. But worse, intemperance pursues irrational pleasure with calm, with slight desire. Opposite intemperance sits temperance, who, thinking of the paper she must finish and the early classes in the morning, reasons that she has had her limit. Her will concurs, and she says, "Thanks so much, but no, I'm heading home." Now, we see temperance choose the rational good. What we do not see is the essence of the virtue, because it is interior in the sense appetite, which follows the guidance of the intellect and will. What does this mean? Temperance experiences no interior struggle, no interior conflict. She feels no displeasure or sorrow when she refuses the next pint. With joy, she goes home. Now, setting those two aside, it gets a little more interesting. What about continence and incontinence? Some of us, I would say, might identify more easily with these two figures, who do not yet have perfect self-mastery that comes with temperance, but neither are they at the level of vice, whereby they will whatever the passions desire. Hearing intemperance's offer, the reason of both continence and incontinence says, not a good idea. But the passions of both say, give me another. Now, having all experienced this conflict at some point, even if not about alcoholic beverages, we can easily imagine the internal conversation that is going on. I'd like another beer. Oh, but I should say no. Oh, I have a paper to finish. I have an early class. But, another beer will help me relax. It'll help me think more clearly. I shouldn't let intemperance drink alone. I'll leave after one more, etc., etc. Now, despite these similarities on the level of knowing the good and the unruly passions, continence and incontinence are not identical. Though continence lacks the ease of temperance and struggles against vehement desires, he normally manages to resist, to contain himself, tenetse. And Aristotle, therefore, he aligns it with perseverance. There's something of a determination here. Incontinence, on the other hand, will normally fail to resist the passion and is therefore often associated with softness. If both continence and incontinence experience vehement movements of passion due to disordered sensitive appetites, but continence resists, it's clear that vehement passion alone is an insufficient cause for incontinence. If it were sufficient, then both would fail to do the good. Neither can the difference between the two lie solely in the intellect, because both continence and incontinence know that the extra pint is not a true good, something of which intemperance was totally ignorant. Still, on the level of ignorance, there is a difference between continence and incontinence. Incontinence knows the rational good, I should not have another beer. But his will is inclined to sin through a passion. His ignorance is that of a particular detail of choice. In a moment of vehement passion, he's blinded to this good, and therefore he chooses to have another beer. But when the movement of the passion ends, he repents, unlike intemperance. And once again, he sees clearly that what he did was wrong. If neither the intellect nor the passions are the sufficient cause of continence, where else can it be? It must be in the will, that power of the soul whose act is to choose. And so, continence, though subject to vehement desires, chooses not to follow them. Continence is struggling, but winning. While incontinence chooses to follow them, although reason forbids it. His will is too weak, too soft. Passions hold sway. He is struggling, but losing. Now, this discussion of continence and incontinence has been used in many theological debates. Today, Gene Porter, Craig Stephen Titus, and others use it in discussion of the flawed saint. Who is the flawed saint? The person who is trying to do the good, but lies somewhere along the continuum between full virtue and full vice. These two terms are also implicated in psychological and moral discourse, which speak of training the passions. Some of these in a manner reminiscent of Pavlovian conditioning, or Walter Mischel's 1960 marshmallow study with preschoolers aged 4 and 5, which tested the ability of 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds to delay gratification, to say no to their desires. Now, normal human development demands something of a training in the early years of childhood. As the child grows and reaches the age of reason, when we can formally speak of voluntary action, the child acquires intellectual knowledge about the good of sharing, the good of being polite, and of not fighting. The child is also trained to say no to vehement desires, to move from intemperance to continence. This training of the young child has echoes of Aristotle's pleasure and sorrow on a very primitive level. The young child has a fear of pain, discipline. If you don't stop that, or of desiring pleasure. If you're good, you will receive pleasure, pain. Regardless of the motivation, if a child repeatedly makes good choices, the will naturally be strengthened. The child will grow in resilience, developing an ability to withstand movements of passion, moving towards continence. But the child or the adult will never achieve mature integration and perfect self-mastery by mere training. The will's containment of vehement desires, though a step towards integration, can be said to contradict, in a way, the perfection of the sensitive powers of the rational person. What do I mean by this? Unlike animals, whose movement follows at once the concupiscible and irascible appetites, like the sheep that immediately runs away from the wolf, the appetites of the rational man wait for the command of the will, which is the superior power. But self-mastery and true virtue implies more than the sense appetite being trained to follow the external command of the will. True virtue is nothing else than a certain habitual conformity of these powers to reason. This habitual conformity is acquired by repeated like acts of proportional intensity. By these acts, the will becomes stronger, suppresses vehement passions so that it can achieve the rational good. But perfect self-mastery is only achieved when the sense appetite is perfected from within, so that its every movement of passion, is in accord with reason. Only then does one arrive at virtue, at temperance, whereby he can choose the good easily and with pleasure. I will close with two major conclusions summarizing both the negative and the positive elements of passion. First, the relation between passion and virtue is not merely moderating vehement desires for alcohol or other sensible goods. But since it is natural in the human person for the passions to be ordered to reason, and since all the virtues are connected with prudence, as auriga virtutum, the charioteer of virtues, if the passions are not subject to reason, they will actually pose a threat to all virtue by hindering reason. And here I would refer to three specific ways which are all relative to passion. Number one, the passions will distract reason because we attend much to that which pleases us. to the passions by being contrary to reason when excess will actually go against the reason. As Aristotle says, bodily pleasures destroy the estimate of prudence. Thirdly, they will fetter reason when vehement passion is followed by bodily disturbances, as in the case of drugs and alcohol, but there are others we can also speak of. That's the negative. On the positive side, the passions are essential for reconnecting virtue. Returning to the original passage from G.K. Chesterton, he adds that the maddest virtues in the world, where the religious scheme is shattered, are precisely those of the intellect. Since seeking truth and justice without passion, without the heart, often leads to merciless acts of cruelty. C.S. Lewis said much the same thing in his well-known essay when he condemned a society that fabricated men without chests, men and women without passion. He doesn't use Thomistic terms, but the sense is still there. Quote, without the aid of trained emotions, the intellect is powerless against the animal organism. In battle, it is not syllogisms, logical arguments, that will keep the reluctant nerves and muscles to their post in the third hour of the bombardment. The head rules the belly through the chest. The head rules the belly through the chest. The chest, the seat of magnanimity, great-souledness. The seat of emotions organized, he says, by trained habit into stable sentiments. This chest magnanimity sentiment, he continues, are indispensable liaison officers between cerebral man and visceral man. He adds, since the human being by his intellect is mere spirit, and by his appetite mere animal, we can conclude that it may even be said that it is by this middle element, by virtuous passion, that man is man. Thank you.
Before I forget, after the questions, there is wine in the refectory. We've got some time for questions now, so.
I could use that example. No, I'm just
kidding. Just to add on to that example. Yeah, we'll be watching everyone. Let's see if you're in temperance or not. So, questions?
Yes.
I was fascinated, Sister, when you were talking about sorrow, which you touched on quite briefly. Two things, really. I mean, I find that in the situation of confession, a lot of times exactly what you described happens, and that distinction between the passions and acts proceeding or resulting from them are not distinguished by the penitent very well. And this often leads to the fact that one of the sins, in inverted commas, that people accuse themselves of is being unhappy. They confess their unhappiness, their sorrow, and obviously in that they blame themselves and they consider it to be an act of malice somehow. And this I find very upsetting, obviously, and I find very important to unpick in the confessional. I wonder if you could comment on that, and also then when you said about St. Thomas's comment that for the man who of virtue, there is a certain way in which we can say sorrow is a proper state, given that we are in Via and not yet in the homeland of heaven. I thought that was very interesting. I wonder if you could comment on them, on those two things.
Yes, so Father was asking regarding this whole question of unhappiness and a person confessing unhappiness. First, I would say, the distinction that I made earlier of the passions in themselves are neutral. The movement of the passion, and we could make the distinction between antecedent passion, which is passion that comes before the reason and the will get involved, And in that sense, that passion that comes before, if the reason and will are not involved at all, it's still neutral. It's when the reason and the will are involved. Now, antecedent passion also, though, if it moves the intellect and will when they're involved, it's sinful because it's the mover and it is not to be the mover. That it is to be guided by the intellect and the will. So the question here is, why am I unhappy? Because unhappiness is a passion. Now, am I the cause? Is there something that I've done? So the question I would say immediately when someone says, I'm unhappy and I feel like I've done something bad, well, what did you do? Because just feeling unhappy is not a sin. There are times where we should feel unhappy, Thomas would say. And so does the church. There are times when you should be unhappy. We should be unhappy about injustices. This is what Thomas means, back to the second point regarding sorrow. In our current state of life, if you're not sorrowful, are you human? Are you living in a false world? Why? Because sorrow is an interesting passion. The object of sorrow is evil, which is exactly why the Stoics wanted to get rid of it. They did not think virtue could have evil as an object. Thomas says, yes, there is a virtue regarding sorrow because we are not God and we live in a fallen world. And we will experience sorrow. And any time we experience that sorrow, we respond to that. Anytime we experience that evil, we respond to that with sorrow. If no evil existed, then we should not feel sorrow. But because evil exists, that's exactly what Thomas is saying. Because there is evil in the world, the rational man will experience sorrow. Is that all right for those? Any other? Yes.
I have a question about, I'm interested in sort of contemporary understandings of certain psychological conditions,
yes.
Or say, for instance, depression.
Yes.
So many have interpretations of depression as being a biological and genetical condition. So I wonder how can the sort of Thomistic framework of emotions and passions tackle this type of contemporary understandings of certain expressions of emotions?
First, I would say Thomas wouldn't tackle them. But I would say Thomas has a solid psychology. We see his anthropology is very rational, but very much based in reality. But you also have to be aware, when you're reading Thomas's treatises on virtue and vice, he is not speaking of psychotic behaviors. He is speaking of rational men and women who have the ability, the intellectual capacity to act voluntarily, whereby their act is moral. So if you're speaking of even the question of the alcohol, I did not bring in the alcoholic. I would be speaking there of people who might drink excessively but do not have the biological addiction. Why? Because with the biological addiction, I do not even have that capacity. I have lost something of my freedom. So it's another level. Now, does that mean Thomas ignores it? Not at all. But it's something to be very aware of when you're dealing with psychological problems. It's something when you're dealing with priests and seminarians, which I always note. We can speak of, in the confessional, we're speaking of virtue vice, not of psychological addictions. That is not the capacity of the priest. Because there you are dealing with something that is beyond the moral capacity. Now we have to come back to and try to regain something of a healthy human condition, which is why you have to deal with the addiction first, prior to being able to deal with the moral judgment of the person. So I would just say, first of all, you have to make those distinctions. And that when Thomas is speaking of virtue and vice, we are not speaking of addictions. Nor is he speaking of character traits and temperament. So when we're speaking of certain people have more of a natural tendency towards certain virtues and certain vices. you want to talk about the basic four temperaments of the choleric, the sanguine, the phlegmatic, and the melancholic, they're all going to have natural tendencies towards virtue and vice, but those virtue and vice are the permanent dispositions. I would say in the same category, so you've got this natural temperament, natural character. In that category, you also have perhaps these psychological or physiological issues to deal with. Those are taken into account. They are not negated. Because we are all human, they are a part of our life. But they are not specifically, we have to make those distinctions of when does the moral, when am I truly free, and the moral capacity is coming into it to make those judgments. Now that's a beginning. Do you want to continue with that? Because there's much more, but I first just wanted to set up some distinctions on that point. Right. Yes?
I'm wondering if you could just clarify quite practically, if you're moving from incontinence to continence to virtue, what's going on, what's changing in you?
Okay. This is the point where, and if we, we don't have the board over, but when you're looking at incontinence, and I didn't do a PowerPoint with this, but we can, but I would say just consider the line across. Temperance is the perfection of virtue. Intemperance is here at the other end. And this is the key. Those two we understand. But the key are these two parts in between. This incontinence, which is not a full vice, and this continence, which is not perfect virtue. This is why I noted, where do they lie? This is critical to understand. Because intemperance is a problem of intellect, will, and passion. That's why we're going to leave that one aside. Temperance, we've got the intellect, will, everything is well ordered. I think everybody can kind of get something of an understanding of that. Most of us, as I say, lie somewhere in the middle. And this is the understanding of what's going on in that incontinent person and in the continent person. Because they may, first of all, what do they look like? If you go back to the bar, the temperate person says no. Who else says no? The continent person. They both do the same thing and they look alike. But are they both virtuous? No, but sometimes they think they are. This is the problem. Oftentimes, the continent person thinks they've got virtue. In fact, they think they have more virtue than the temperate person because they're struggling so hard. And yet they're doing the good. And often they can become judgmental of people who are not doing the good or say, I must be more virtuous because I'm working so hard at it. But they're not. They don't have the full virtue. They have a strong will, which is good. But just to emphasize the will be problematic. Because they will focus on the will, and the problem that comes in is pride. Because we think we've made it, and we think we're better than the other guys, and we aren't there yet. There we need something of the education, of understanding what the true virtue is. We still need the strong will. This is why you don't want to break a child's will. Because we need the will, because of the sorrow in the world, we need the will to get to that virtue. We have to move along. And if we don't have that strong will, we're going to be back in incontinence, where we're falling all of the time. So I would say the emphasis there is recognizing the strong will, but not focusing solely on the strong will. Something of the formation of the intellect needs to come in there. But ultimately, you're looking at continuing to follow that goodwill, and the rational good. And as I keep doing that, eventually my passions, by that repetition, become well-ordered. The incontinent person, though, what's going on? What do you do with the incontinent person? Well, they don't have a strong will. Their tendency is to fall into depression, to get discouraged. Why? Because they know the good that they should do, they want to do it, and they keep failing. And they keep coming to Father in confession and falling into the same, and I did the same thing over and over again. Or if they're not going to confession, it doesn't matter. They're still struggling with themselves, and they get depressed. Or they become discouraged. I'm trying so hard, and I can't make it. Ultimately, what do they need? Grace. But also helped along there is they need to strengthen the will. Well, how do you strengthen the will? By doing the good act. But depending on what you're struggling with, in the tradition, in the spiritual tradition, depending on which sin you're struggling with, depends on how you respond to it. Why? Here I would specifically mention problems of lust. Sexual sins, all the spiritual writers throughout history have said, you flee from those. You don't fight them. Some we fight, some we flee. They're so powerful. Those passions are so strong that if we give them attention, we will most likely fall. Therefore, if someone's dealing with struggles regarding sexual sin, you don't want them to focus on it, per se, because most likely they'll fall into it again. Well, what do you have to do? If you strengthen the will, because the virtues are connected, if you can strengthen the will regarding something else that is easier, which is why, again, throughout tradition, Christian tradition, what have all the spiritual masters said regarding chastity? What do you need to practice? Abstinence, fasting. Why? What are you doing? In saying no to something that is easier to say no to, I'm strengthening my will. So instead of focusing on the sexuality, perhaps I'm focusing on something of food and saying no to some other pleasure, whereby I can say no to something simpler, strengthen my will, which will enable me in the future to say no to those more vehement passions. Yes.
Yes, I have a question about the kind of control involved in virtue of temperance or the moral virtues. You distinguish despotic and political authority or control. Despotic control over the body, but political control over the passions, because the passions have the capacity to resist. In the virtuous person, does the political control approach despotic control, so that the passions are completely obedient to reason, because they no longer resist at all, they're just completely obedient? And if so, is that not a sort of too controlling vision of moral virtue, that, that we've got our passions so tightly under control that they do exactly what our reason and our will tells them? I'm just a little bit worried that that's too tense, too kind of controlling a vision of moral virtue.
As you've expressed it, I would agree. Which is why I made some of the distinctions that I did regarding training, as well as the distinction of really understanding the distinction between continence and temperance. Because continence is that controlling aspect. I would say if we're seeing it as where it is the will controlling and it's that despotic, that is not the fullness of virtue. And it's not in the full nature of what the passions are about and the sensible appetite. It's a movement moving towards. As long as we're not here in intemperance and we're moving along, that's good. But many times, as I say, people get to continence with that despotic, it's still a despotic rule. Now, as I say, that despotic rule is not necessarily bad. It's from external, because it's not in the sense appetite itself. When we have virtue in the sense appetite, it is a freedom. But unless you, when you experience that, whereby you freely, you've been struggling with something, whether it's the alcohol, whether it's your temper, whatever it is, and you've been struggling with something for a long time, whether it's just sitting down and studying, and you're struggling and trying to do the good, and you struggle over a period of time, and we know it takes at least 30 days to make a habit, one day to break it. It takes a long time, but sometimes we aren't even aware when we have the virtue until we look back and we realize it has become easy in a sense. And it's not because I'm forcing myself. I'm no longer forcing. This is exactly what Aristotle and Thomas are saying. No, it's not the despotic rule. There's something whereby that passion within itself is doing what, it, regarding its proper object, it is choosing its proper object. So it's not against its nature, which is why it's not despotic. If the nature of my sensitive appetite is to enjoy the good, the true good, the sensible good of food, of the beautiful sun, the beautiful weather here in Oxford, if that's what I'm made for, when I enjoy that, and it's not merely my will forcing, this is when true happiness comes in. Happiness even in the midst of sorrow, because it's not merely my will forcing. So I would totally agree, we have to be very careful of a despotic understanding of virtue. That is not what Thomas is saying. And this is exactly why that distinction between continence and temperance is so fundamental. Because if we're on that despotic rule, and yes, I'm doing it, it's going, as I say, against the nature of the sensitive appetite. Because the sensitive appetite is made to be governed by, but it's also made to freely choose the good that it was made for. And that proper good is the rational good.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
Thank you, sister.
Thank you, Dean.
I'm wondering if you could give some more examples of a situation in which it's less virtuous to lack a passion and it's more virtuous to have an abundance of passion.
Yes, I would say, let's take an example, and this is where, when Thomas would make the distinction of the antecedent consequent passion. Are there times where I should feel passionate about something? Maybe I don't feel passionate about something. Now, the issue here would be, let's take an injustice. We've got many injustices, we know, even in the Catholic Church today. And so when someone hears of an injustice, of an abuse, and someone has no response to it, should we feel, the response to an injustice is usually something of an anger. There's been a slight done, and I feel something of that slight. Even if it's not to me personally, I identify with that. Should I feel angry? Now, the problem here is that many people then immediately think, I should be enraged, and I should show it. That's not what Thomas is saying. Thomas would say this anger that I should feel if a true injustice is done, the rational anger I should feel is more of a judgment. That is unjust. But my anger is in accord with reason. And I should feel passion, the passion that is the judgment, but includes something of an anger. It doesn't have to be today where the media tries to get you enraged about everything. That's not what Thomas is speaking of. We're not talking about manipulation or just emotional outburst. We're talking about a rational judgment of an injustice done, which causes me in a way, yes, I'm angry about the injustices. That doesn't mean I have to go picket or go do whatever to show how angry I am. So I would say that's the question of the virtuous passion that I should feel when something unjust. The bombing in Sri Lanka, Burkina Faso, we just had that. Okay, but those things, should we feel that there was an injustice done? Innocent human beings were attacked and killed. Yes. As to the, then you asked about the irrational or the excessive passion. Well, the same thing can be said. Okay, I'm upset about this, so I'm going to go kill a Muslim. Wrong. Why? My movement of passion, there's an injustice done, but now what happens? My reason needs to enter in. So I have the movement of passion, there's an injustice. But reason needs to come in and say, that's another human being. I have to treat them with respect. And if, even if it's the criminal who committed the crime, just they need to be treated justly, and my anger has to be directed in a proper manner. Is that all right for, I think I hit both of your points.
So thank you very much again, sister.
Thank you.